Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You're listening to everything you wanted to know about drone warfare, but we're afraid to ask. And as we join the program, Avery Plott is defending the use of drones.
So, first argument, effectiveness. Drone strikes are highly effective both directly and indirectly. In regards to direct effects, drone strikes kill a lot of leaders of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and a lot of lower-level militants as well. For example, U.S. officials claim, I think plausibly, that 21 of the top 30 Al-Qaeda leadership targets have been killed by drones, including, for example, Atiyah Abd al-Rahman, who reportedly became Al-Qaeda number 2 after the death of bin Laden. More broadly, the main databases tracking drone strikes report the following numbers of leaders or high-value targets killed. The UMass drone database, on which I've worked, has identified 82, and you can actually see short bios of each and pictures, where available, at umassdrone.org. The Long War Journal counts 80. The New America Foundation lists 51. So there are quite a lot on all counts. In regards to suspected militants, that is, other than leaders, the numbers are much larger. The UMass drone database records 2,101 suspected militants killed. That's 75.3% of total fatalities resulting from drone strikes. The New America Foundation database records 2,601 suspected militants killed, making up about 80% of total fatalities. The Long War Journal records 2,414 suspected militants killed, comprising 91.2% of the fatalities that they've recorded. And even the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is generally hostile to drone strikes, records some 2,415 suspected militants killed, or 72% of the total. Now, obviously, there's some variation in the numbers reported here, and it should be noted that all the databases are based in large part on media reports, which are often individually of dubious reliability. But I think that the general pattern that's reflected across all the databases, across all the years from 2004 onwards, well, 2002 if you count the first strike in Yemen, give a loose indication of what's going on. And they show that the Jones strikes are actually doing some very real and very substantial damage to the targeted groups. On top of these direct results, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence suggesting that drone strikes are actually doing more general harm to the targeted groups as well, in particular creating a climate of fear, keeping leaders in particular on the move, preventing assemblies and training, disrupting communications, etc. These observations come up often actually in local reporting. They're reflected in the behavior of the groups themselves, and they're perhaps most clearly seen in intercepted communications, including from the hideout of bin Laden, who is clearly struggling in his letters to figure out how to respond to drone strikes. He writes, "Our Waziristani brothers are frankly exhausted from the enemy's air bombardments." He complains that they cannot safely move recruits into the Fatah, that the leadership is becoming inexperienced through attrition, and he contemplates abandoning their former safe havens altogether. I think all indicate a substantial effect of the drone strikes, particularly in Pakistan. Second argument, the safety of the operators. A second obvious advantage of using drones is that they don't endanger the teams that are operating them, for they remain safely back on secure bases. Now, I want to stress that the protection of soldiers, even if they're safely on base, should never be bought at the cost of unnecessarily endangering civilians. And I'll talk about civilians in a second. But other things being equal, a tactic that protects soldiers is better than one that exposes them, as the alternative counter-terrorist tactics do. Third argument, discrimination. I just mentioned the importance of protecting civilians, and this is an area where critics have been especially vocal in objecting to drones. In particular, drones have often been charged with visiting disproportionate harm on civilians. Now, this charge is wholly understandable in at least one sense, for the killing of a civilian, even if wholly unintentional, is no less tragic. It is also true, however, that some civilian deaths are an inevitable feature of war, particularly as it is often fought today, with one side hiding deliberately in the civilian population. So there's also a sense in which the complaint against U.S. drones, or at least this complaint, seems odd. For most of the data that we have suggests that U.S. drones are pretty discriminating, especially when compared to the alternatives. For example, according to the Long War Journal database, civilians make up only 5.8% of casualties resulting from drone strikes. The New America Foundation estimates actually that civilians make up maybe 14%. However, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism suggests that the civilian toll is considerably higher, maybe as high as 22.6% if you average the ranges that they present, or if you take the very top number at the top of their ranges, around 24%. Finally, according to the UMass drone database, very clear civilian casualties make up only 3.7% of the total killed, at least in Pakistan, although the database also includes another category of unknowns, that is, cases where there's not enough data to really be confident about whether the person killed was a civilian or not. And this category accounts for 20.8% of those killed, at least in Pakistan. Now, obviously, there's some divergence among these numbers, but it can be explained. The UMass drone data, and particularly the category of unknowns, is actually the key. Because when you add that 20.8% of unknowns to the very clear civilian cases at 3.7%, what you get is 24.5%, which is exactly the number at the very top of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's range. In other words, the difference between the lowest proportion of civilians killed and the highest is exactly this 20.8% of unknowns, people that it's very hard to determine. So, in other words, the difference between the drone database's results is how they're counting that 20.8%. So the Long War Journal, for example, tends to classify unknowns as suspected militants, and as a result, they get a count of only 5.8%, whereas the Bureau of Investigative Journalism counts every case in which there's the remotest doubt about whether the person could be a civilian as a civilian, and the result is that they end up with a number like 24%. So if this quick analysis is at all accurate, what we can say with some confidence is that the rate is probably somewhere between the low end 3.7% and the top end 24%, depending on how the unknown cases should really be assigned, which is something we'll probably never know for sure. The New America Foundation estimate of around 14% might be a good rule of thumb. But Even if we accept the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's numbers at face value and say that civilian casualties could be as high as 24%, they're still smaller than that associated with alternative means of conducting counterterror operations in the area, and actually also for combat in general in this era. For example, data gathered by UMass Drone shows that U.S. non-drone operations in the FATA, that's the federally administrated tribal agencies of Pakistan where the drone strikes are taking place, that is commando raids and precision artillery strikes, attacks other than with drones, have killed a much higher proportion of civilians than drones at around 37.5% as opposed to the possibly 24% for the drone strikes. And in fact, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism actually shows the same pattern where it separates out drone strikes and non-drone strikes, as in it does for Yemen, for example. Similarly, the Pakistani army is reported to have killed a greater proportion of civilians than drone strikes in their operations in the FATA between 2002 and 2007, specifically 31.3% as opposed to possibly 24%, as high as 24% for the drone strikes. And the Pakistani army obviously also produced thousands of refugees and also itself experienced casualties among its soldiers that don't occur with drone strikes. A final point of comparison is the most widely cited estimate of the rate of civilian casualties characterizing all conflicts in the 1990s from Martin Van Creveldt. It's used by many authors writing about contemporary war. That is 8 civilian deaths for each combatant killed. And obviously, this proportion of civilian casualties, which is over 88%, is much higher. It dwarfs the casualties produced by drones at as high as 24%. So I suggest that the civilian casualties resulting from drone strikes are horrible, certainly, but actually they are more modest than the available alternatives. And a final important point that needs to be made here regarding civilian casualties is that all of the databases that record this information show sharply falling rates of civilian casualties over the last 4 years. If you average the databases together and separate them by year, these are the numbers that you get. In 2009, the average rate was 12.8%. In 2010, it fell to 4.15%. There was a bump back up over 2011 to 8.48%. And in 2012, the number fell to 1.57% of all the casualties were civilian casualties. And finally, the number of civilian casualties so far in 2013 is extremely low as well. Even the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which, as I noted, tends to skew high, shows only 0 to 4 civilian casualties in Pakistan for 2013 as of last week. And two of the other databases actually show 0 so far this year. Fourth argument, the absence of alternatives. One additional important point relating especially to Pakistan, where most of the drone strikes have occurred, is that there are no viable alternatives to go after al-Qaeda leaders. The Pakistanis have reacted very angrily to any visible American boots on the ground. The most prominent example was a commando raid in a town in South Waziristan on September 3rd, 2008, which resulted in Pakistan's General Kayani publicly promising to attack American forces and shoot down helicopters if it was ever repeated. So in essence, Leon Panetta had good reason to describe the drone strikes as the only game in town. His point, in the absence of any other viable choices, we're stuck with the drones.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Final argument, trickiest argument, legality. So this brings me to the last point that I want to make, and that is this. I think a strong case can be made that a state of war exists between the United States and al-Qaeda and Taliban forces, and that most drone strikes, albeit perhaps not all, are permissible under that law. I'm not a lawyer. My wife is the lawyer in the family, as she frequently reminds me, and we have some lawyers with us, perhaps, who will disagree with my assessment. But I rely here on leading scholars of the law of armed conflict, from Michael Schmidt to Yoram Dinstein to Marco Seale. And I'll emphasize, this is also the view of the president, who was a constitutional lawyer before he became president, the attorney general, and the Office of Legal Counsel, which also cites the U.S. Supreme Court in supporting this opinion. Their common view is that the practice and opinio iuris of states has changed at least since September 11th, after September 11th, if not before, to accept the possibility of a non-international armed conflict between a state and a terrorist group, permitting the state to use military force against the terrorist group subject to the law of armed conflict. Such action can be taken on the territory of another sovereign state with the consent of that state, even if that consent is secretly given, or if that state proves persistently unwilling or unable to prevent an ongoing pattern of attacks. Finally, I don't think that there's anything about drone strikes in particular that necessarily violates the humanitarian law on the conduct of war itself. Indeed, drone's capability to loiter patiently, to track acutely, to strike with great precision, give them the capability of greater proportionality than other weapons. So it makes sense for them to be the preferred weapon of those who believe that we can make war on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. On the other hand, drones will understandably be rejected by those who reject the idea of a war between a state and a terrorist organization, and I think there is genuine controversy over this. Armed drones are clearly weapons of war and not of law enforcement. They cannot demand surrender or negotiate or arrest anyone. They are designed to kill. But please note, if you take this view that there cannot be a war between the United States and a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, then you must equally reject, for example, the killing of Osama bin Laden, which was an operation equally intended to kill, even if it didn't use drones to do the killing. But I don't think that most Americans do condemn that operation because they do see it as an act of war. And I think that they're right to do so. But just because I think that drones strikes against imminent terrorist threats that cannot otherwise be neutralized are defensible in principle doesn't mean that I approve of everything that the U.S. currently is doing with them. In particular, I'd point to signature strikes as an objectionable current use of drones. Signature strikes contrast with what are termed personality strikes, where the drone strikes are aimed at a particular named person who has been placed on a list of legitimate targets. Signature strikes, by contrast, are not based on the individual identity of the target, but on an observed pattern of life which suggests combatancy, like affiliating with known terrorists, or providing them with shelter, or carrying weapons. Now, I think that it's doubtful whether these patterns of life, in many cases, are sufficient to establish combatant status, and that the law, ethics, and common sense require that doubtful cases be treated as civilians, and therefore not targeted. I suspect that at times the U.S. has failed to properly draw this distinction, and that does need to be rectified. But because they have at times been misused, is no more reason to prohibit the use of drones than it would be to ban helicopters, because they have at times been misused. What's required now is to clarify the rules governing their use and to tighten oversight and accountability to make certain that these uniquely effective weapons are used, but used properly.
Thank you, Avery. Our final speaker will be Gregory Johnson from Princeton, and then we'll open it up for some moderation, followed by questions from the audience.
Thanks. Thanks to Tom and Vicky for inviting me, and obviously all of you for coming. It's a great treat for me to be on the same panel with David and with Avery. It's quite a nice evening, and I hope that continues through my talk. We'll see. Drones are an amazing piece of technology, and that technology isn't going to go away. The technology is with us. As I think David pointed out, more and more countries are going to get this technology. But one of the reasons that we're having the discussion that we're having tonight is because of a failure of foresight from both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Neither Republicans nor Democrats have really put in place either a legal, an ethical, or even a policy framework for how it is that drones should be used. In fact, we're now hearing, as we hear much about the drone program from anonymous sources, from leaks in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that the Obama administration is scrambling to put together some sort of a drone playbook. Drones, I think, they can be a very effective weapon, or they can be a weapon that does more harm than good. And that's what I'd really like to talk about tonight, because the way that drones are described, they're talked about as being legal, as being ethical, and as being wise. I think David did a great job talking about the legality, as did Avery, who touched on it. The ethics is something that we can debate in the question and answers. But I'd like to talk about the wisdom of drone strikes and the effectiveness of drone strikes. I think drones are a particularly seductive weapon, as David pointed out. The threat to American lives when using drones is neither immediate nor apparent. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. The term blowback comes to mind. What it is that America is doing abroad in the name of U.S. citizens is something that all of us, as voters, as members of this country, need to take very, very seriously. David also mentioned the ease at which drones can be used. And I think this is an important thing, because having a weapon that you can push a button and without, again, putting any American lives at immediate or apparent risk is a very seductive thing. And it almost, I think in many cases, it has given some U.S. policymakers the idea that drones can act as some sort of magic missile solution to an incredibly difficult and a very complex problem. And I think one of the things that we see, Avery did a fantastic job, I think, of pointing out how many people are killed, when they're killed, who are civilians, who are militants, who are suspected militants, who do we know, who do we not know. One of the things that I'm not sure about, however, is whether body bags are a very good barometer to measure success by in a war like this. Is the number of people that the U.S. is killing, does that mean that we're actually winning this war? Does the fact that Osama bin Laden is dead, does that mean that the U.S. is defeating al-Qaeda? We see al-Qaeda in Syria. We see them in Yemen. We see Mali. We see al-Qaeda seeming to pop up everywhere, and yet the U.S. is killing more people than ever before. So what does this tell us about our current U.S. strategy? These, I think, are some very important questions that we need to be asking. Another thing that I think needs to be talked about, and I don't think it often is that drones are very dependent. They're dependent upon human intelligence on the ground. You can have an incredibly accurate drone that hits the car that's driving down the road in Yemen, but if the wrong people are in the car, it doesn't matter that you hit what you were aiming at. You killed the wrong person. And it's this lack of human intelligence, or rather bad human intelligence, that I think is really the Achilles heel of U.S. intelligence agencies in places like Yemen and in places like Pakistan. And in fact, as we've seen, organizations like the CIA move from doing what it is that the CIA has done over the past 10 or 20 years, which is gather, analyze intelligence. And as we see in a place like Yemen, for instance, David mentioned this, and Avery did, JSOC runs a drone program in Yemen, but there's a parallel program run by the CIA as well. And so you have two competing U.S. agencies who are both flying their own drones, both have their own separate kill list that they're going after. I think it would be much better if the CIA and JSOC were cooperating much, much more and letting the military run the drone operation and letting the CIA provide the intelligence. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening, or at least it doesn't seem to be what's happening in a very effective way. I've been back and forth to Yemen for the past 10 years, and the four Americans that have been killed in drone strikes have been in Yemen. Obviously, I'm not a member of al-Qaeda, so I think I'm safe there, but it's still a little worrying giving some of the people that I talk to when I'm in Yemen how some of these people are dying, because according to what it is that we know, only one individual, only Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric who was killed in September of 2011, he was the only individual who was on the U.S. kill list. The other three individuals, Kamal Darwish, who was killed in November of 2002, Samar Khan, who was killed in the same strike that killed Anwar al-Awlaki, and Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, an individual named Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, those last three, none of them were intended targets, and yet they're all dead. I want to spend a little bit of time in the few minutes that I have left talking about Yemen and looking at the U.S. approach there. On Christmas Day 2009, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the organization that's based in Yemen, they put a would-be suicide bomber on a plane over Detroit. Thankfully for all of us, he was unsuccessful. The bomb failed to detonate. At that point in time, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group in Yemen, this group that the U.S. is very concerned about and rightly concerned about, was about 200 or 300 individuals. That's estimates from both the Yemeni government and from the U.S. government. I've tracked al-Qaeda for quite some time in Yemen. I think those numbers are probably pretty accurate. Today, after more than 3 years of strikes, the vast majority of which have been drone strikes, the organization has more than tripled in size. It's well over 1,000 fighters. In fact, the State Department puts it as a few thousand fighters. So if the Obama administration continually says that what it's doing in places like Yemen or in places like Pakistan is disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda, but if we look at, if we're just measuring the organization in terms of how many fighters it has, what appears to be happening is that after 3 years of strikes, instead of disrupting, dismantling, and defeating, we seem to be exacerbating the problem and expanding the threat from al-Qaeda. Avery talked about the two different types of drone strikes, and I want to mention these as well. There's the high-value targeted strikes, which tend to rely on a particular piece of intelligence that know an individual is in the car or at the place. This is, for instance, the strike that killed Anwar al-Awlaki. They don't necessarily know everybody else who's in the car. They didn't necessarily know that Samar Khan was there, but they knew Anwar al-Awlaki was there. Then there's the signature strikes. Sometimes these strikes are referred to by individuals within the CIA as crowd killing. That should give you some sort of an idea of what's taking place. And in a place like Yemen, this is really, really dangerous, because not everybody who has a beard and carries a gun and talks about Islamic law, is a member of Al-Qaeda. If the U.S. expands the circle of who it is that it's targeting, it tends to drive more and more individuals into the arms of Al-Qaeda. I think what the U.S. needs to be doing is limiting the circle of who it is that it's targeting in places like Yemen. Identities and how it is that we count the casualties are also very, very important. The U.S. tends to count any unidentified male of military age, which usually means over 16 or 18, as a suspected militant. Now, that might work in Washington, but that's not how these people are seen on the ground in Yemen. On the ground in Yemen, you may even have an individual who is affiliated in some way with Al-Qaeda or knows members of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has members in Yemen who are members of tribes, who are members of particular families. Does that mean the entire tribe is guilty? Does that mean that the entire family is guilty? These are important questions to ask, particularly when the U.S. is using patterns of life or when the U.S. is targeting people based on who it is that they associate with. So if, and even if, say, right, all of us have different identities. So if you're a member of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda might be part of your identity, but you might also be a tribesman. You might also have other affiliations. And so maybe at particular times, you really stress the identity of being an Al-Qaeda member when you're, say, going through a training camp or when you're talking to one of your sheikhs or whatever. But when you're with your tribe, that's the identity that you're stressing. So individuals that the U.S. may even have evidence about, that they may even be affiliated in some way with Al-Qaeda, on the ground, they're seen as tribesmen so often. Let me tell you just a quick anecdote. Last time I was in Yemen was in October, a few months ago. And a Yemeni court sentenced two individuals to death for belonging to Al-Qaeda. And they were Al-Qaeda members. They were also members of a tribe. In retaliation, their tribe cut off the electricity to the capital city. So you have a situation where in the morning, these guys are sentenced to death for being members of Al-Qaeda. In the evening, they're defended as being tribesmen. And this is a real problem for the United States, is determining who it is that these people are, how it is that we identify them, and how it is that we go about targeting them.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.